You may think that once you've made it, actually established your claim to fame, the rest is history. But as it happens, history has a rather short memory. Paul Collins is the author of Banvard's Folly, 13 Tales of Renowned Obscurity, Famous Anonymity, and Rotten Luck. He told Steve Paulson about the celebrated artist John Banvard, who used to be a household name.
His greatest painting became known as the Three Mile Painting, where it was rolled up on either side of a stage with cranks. And so you'd have someone working the crank at one side of the stage on these giant rollers, and the painting would sort of pass along. It was like the first motion picture. And this is in the late 1840s, 1850s. Banvard would be out front narrating this trip. He had painted a gigantic painting of the Mississippi River. And he'd been up and down the Mississippi many times himself. So he gave you this narrated journey down the Mississippi. Actually, depending on, they wouldn't unroll it at the end of the show. So they would roll it back and forth. So depending on which show you went to, you'd either get the upstream tour or the downstream.
So this was a big show. A lot of people would come and pay to see him put on his show.
It was a tremendous success. He toured in Boston, London, Paris, New York. I mean, to give you some notion of how big of a success it was normally about 50 cents admission, and he became a millionaire. And this is in the 1850s when $1 million went quite a long way.
Wow. Well, you write that he was actually the most famous painter, the most famous artist in the world, and maybe the richest as well.
It's a pretty safe bet that he was the richest at his time. I don't know of any other millionaire painters at that time. You know, he did a showing for Queen Victoria, and he had a fan letter from Charles Dickens, and all kinds of writers referenced his work. Yeah, he was tremendously successful. And in fact, with all the money that he made off of it, he came back to the U.S. eventually and built a replica of Windsor Castle out on Long Island to live in. And was doing just fine for a while. He just sort of, you know, settled in and more or less retired there. But he had collected a lot of artifacts at one point. He'd actually gone down the Nile to do a gigantic panoramic painting of the Nile as well, and had collected all kinds of Egyptian artifacts. This was back before antiquities laws. And in the meantime, P.T. Barnum was becoming also famous and wealthy because of his museum in New York, with a lot of artifacts that were of rather more dubious authenticity. And Banvard saw this and thought, hey, I can do that. I've got all these artifacts as well. I'm a good showman. And he was a good showman, but he wasn't as good as Barnum. And that was his undoing. He went head-to-head with Barnum in the museum business, and it was just almost shocking how quickly Barnum clobbered him.
And yet the irony is, at least from what you're saying, John Banvard actually had the better artifacts, but P.T. Barnum was the better showman.
Yeah, Banvard had the better building. It was better ventilated, better designed, had better stuff inside. But what Barnum knew and what Banvard didn't was how powerful advertising was. To the point where, I mean, Barnum would just lie in some of his ads about the stuff he had and about how wonderfully ventilated and cool his buildings were.
This was a big thing, how well ventilated your museum
was.
Yeah,
well, because people complained about it a lot back then. I mean, this is before air conditioning, too. So that was a big draw, kind of, you know, today where people will go to movies to get out of the heat. And he just clobbered Banvard simply because he understood advertising better. And it took down most of Banvard's money. A lot of investors, many of whom promptly began to sue Banvard. The long and the short of it was that Banvard, who had been, you know, this millionaire living out in a castle out on Long Island, eventually wound up in a spare room in his son's house out in the Dakota frontier.
Wow.
And was buried in a pauper's grave. His family actually skipped out of town so that they wouldn't pay the funeral expenses. And none of his panoramic paintings survive. And you won't find a reference to him in really in any art reference book.
So none of his paintings are still around?
None of his panoramic ones. There are a few small panels, but the panoramic paintings themselves are, nobody knows what happens to them. There's one rumor that they were shredded to create insulation for local homes in Watertown, South Dakota. So that's maybe the most ignominious end I could think of for his work.
Well, it's a fascinating case study of fame, how this enormous celebrity, this very rich guy who was celebrated by his fellow Americans in the mid-19th century, how he fell into total obscurity.
It's really shocking, actually. And when I first came across him, I came across like a couple lines about him in a book by Van Wyck Brooks, written in the 1930s. It was actually a literary history where he was talking about Whitman, and he was comparing this grandiose vision of America to these vast panoramic paintings. And when I read about it, I thought, that's interesting. I've never heard of this guy. And it just blew me away that someone like that could be forgotten. But what I came to realize was that that's not an uncommon experience. I think Banvard is one of the more extreme cases, but there's a lot of people like that. We tend, I think, to assign a few figureheads to each era, to each decade that we choose to remember and that sort of represent that time. But there's actually a whole multitude of other people who are as well known and maybe even better known back then that end up being forgotten.
So the question then is, why are some people remembered while others are totally forgotten?
I think there's a couple factors to it. I mean, I think that one is it's just what we find useful. Because we find certain aesthetic qualities pleasing, we'll tend to remember some artists better than others. That's why we remember Emily Dickinson. And yet at the same time, well, someone else I write about in the book, Martin Tupper, was one of the most popular and well-known poets of the day. He sold like 1.5 million copies of a book called Proverbial Philosophy. You know, people would chase him for locks of his hair. He's been out of print for a century.
Now, all of these cases that we've been talking about so far were well-meaning attempts for people to make their mark on the world. But there were some cases of chicanery. for instance, there was
I couldn't resist.
Well, there was this one kid, for instance, who claimed that he had discovered Shakespeare's lost plays and original letters and that kind of thing.
William Henry Ireland, yeah, he's great. He was about, I guess, 18 years old and working as the clerk in a law office. And he had a well-known father. His father was a well-known engraver and collector of antiquarian books. And his son was considered not very smart. But William had a lot of free time working in this law office. It wasn't a very busy place. And so he started trying to forge Shakespearean documents, at first just as a lark. And then he brought one home one day to show to his father. And his father was completely taken in.
But how did he make them look old?
What he would do is, it being a law office, there were a lot of old legal documents sitting around, some of which were hundreds of years old. And so he would cut the blank pages off of these documents and use that as his paper. So it was genuine old paper. This was in the 1790s that this was happening. And he also found a printer who was able to create for him a type of ink that, when you held it over a flame for a moment, it kind of oxidized and looked kind of like an old brown ink. And so it was a very convincing forgery. And in fact, the prime minister, the poet laureate, Boswell, all these luminaries came to visit the Ireland's household and look at these documents. And I think Boswell wept when he saw them. People were completely convinced for some time.
So what were these documents purported to be?
Well, initially, he wasn't too ambitious about it. He just did legal documents because he figured that no one would think that those were fake. But then he started getting a little bit more ambitious and started telling his father that he had found entire manuscripts of plays, of Hamlet, things like that. And then he reached a little too far and said he had found an original play called Vortigern. And William Henry Ireland, who at this point was only 19 years old, in 2 months wrote an entire quote-unquote Shakespearean play. And I might add, doing almost all this work on the play while at work in his law office. So he'd have to like hide it when the cleaning lady came in.
And this was a guy who was supposed to be not too swift in the head.
And well, in fact, the few people that did think that they might be forgeries blamed his father, because absolutely nobody thought that the son was smart enough to do this. No one ever suspected him. And in fact, what happened was the playwright Sheridan took up the play Vortigern and put it on one night. And at that point, a book had just been published to debunk these papers. And so what occurred was a riot at the first showing of Vortigern, to the point where there was a member of parliament in the crowd who was screamingly drunk, and he got up and mooned the entire audience. So it was a pretty out of control performance, and it was not a performance that was repeated. That was the first and last showing of Vortigern.
Paul Collins is the author of Banvard's Folly. He spoke with Steve Paulson.